I mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Bless you.
But
tonight
we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course. You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Of Oregon. It's our fifth episode. It's November 8th. That's not true. It's December 8th, 2006. A lot of news to cover, a lot of anniversaries, a lot of things going on. Today is the 26th anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon. So we're going to listen to a track and also the trailer from the new movie, The U.S. versus John Lennon. And then we'll come back and get into all the news.
The nation is free. There is hope.
You say you've been in trouble all your life. Why is that?
I'm just one of those faces, you know. People never like my face.
D-Ball!
If we succeed, generations to come will say of us now living that we mastered our moment.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love.
You have to be more politically aware in a day and age like this. It's impossible to close your eyes to it.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these.
As South Vietnamese forces become stronger, the rate of American withdrawal can become greater.
Peace in your mind, peace in the world.
We're selling it like soap, peace or war, that's the two products.
There was a fear that John could imperil the political existence of Richard Nixon.
John was daring to speak out.
We came here to say to all of you, apathy isn't it, and that we can do something.
Activities were being monitored.
I was followed in the car, and my phone was tapped. I think they wanted me to know to scare me, and I was scared, paranoid.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service began deportation proceedings.
Will you stop speaking out against the war?
No, nothing will stop me. I'll always say what I feel.
Our society is run by insane people for insane objectives, so I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that.
Their distortion of the Constitution was the greatest disloyalty to this country.
Lenin represented life, and Mr. Nixon and Mr. Bush represent death.
His message is still alive.
Our job now is to tell them that there is still hope. We must get them excited about what we can do again.
The U.S. versus John Lennon.
Laughing in the face of love. What on earth you trying to do?
apathy isn't it, the man said it himself. That's John Lennon. It's December 8th, 2006, and we're here remembering the 26th anniversary of the death of John Lennon. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. It's good to be with you. I'm glad you joined me. You can go to praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. A lot of stuff to get to today, and we'll jump from one anniversary to another, yesterday being the 65th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We're going to listen to a little bit of a History Channel documentary, Conspiracy, FDR, and Pearl Harbor.
A deluge of top-secret reports fell on the desks of America's spymasters. Overwhelmed, the analysts missed clear signs of impending disaster. The intelligence bureaucracies distrusted each other and didn't share information that could have averted an unprecedented attack on the United States. This was not 9/11. It was the 7th of December, 1941. On that day at Pearl Harbor, 2,400 lives were lost. It was a devastating defeat that changed America forever.
The battleship Arizona was completely destroyed and four others severely damaged.
For many years, controversy has surrounded the subject of Pearl Harbor, the event that finally propelled a reluctant nation into the Second World War. But was the surprise attack really a surprise? Who knew about it? And who failed to avert it?
We knew what Japan was up to. We knew it before Pearl Harbor. We knew it all through the war.
From the outset, some experts asserted that the highest echelons of the administration of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew of the Japanese plans in advance and did nothing to stop them. As new evidence emerges, the charges persist, giving rise to fierce debate.
FDR, it seems, obviously wanted the Japanese to surprise and utterly destroy Pearl Harbor.
What motive could Roosevelt possibly have had for doing such a thing?
There's not a drop of evidence. There's speculation, accusation, allegation, and I think sort of dreaming.
What we have here is a cover-up and a conspiracy on the part of the FDR administration.
Did President Roosevelt know in advance? And has a government-led cover-up continued to this day? Sounds of horses' hooves and muffled motorcycle engines heralded the funeral cortege as it moved slowly toward the Capitol. On a caisson, under an American flag, lay the body of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in American history. Four months later, in August 1945, the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered. The war was over. These events marked a transformation, the emergence of the United States as a leading player on the world stage, and a new willingness to investigate the event that catapulted America into the war. 3 months after VJ Day, Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky convened the Joint Congressional Committee on the Investigation of the Pearl Harbor Attack. This exhaustive review produced 25,000 pages of testimony and documentation. The committee laid much of the blame on the commanders at Pearl Harbor and largely exonerated Roosevelt and his senior advisors. But its conclusions resulted in charges of cover-up and cronyism. Now, in the 21st century, as the American government declassifies reams of World War II documents, some experts are reopening the case for a conspiracy.
The only way that the Japanese could pull off such a real and complete and total victory at Pearl Harbor was if FDR and his administration was to withhold the vital intelligence from Pearl Harbor. The question is, why did FDR withhold it?
Richard Hill is an historian with a PhD from Georgetown University. He contends that FDR and members of his cabinet were aware of the Japanese plans to attack Hawaii.
General Marshall and Admiral Stark, and indeed FDR, indeed knew that Pearl Harbor was being painted for a bombing run by the Japanese.
On the 9th of October 1941, an intercepted diplomatic cable from Japanese High Command arrived at the Office of Naval Intelligence in Washington. Some months previously, America had cracked Japan's secret codes. It meant that cryptographers were able to decipher a coded message sent from Tokyo to its spies in Hawaii. That missive has since become known as the bomb plot message. After the war, the Congressional Committee examined the bomb plot message. Officers questioned about it had passed it off as unremarkable at the time. But the committee heard one general testify that the bomb plot message was in fact unique. Of the thousands of decoded Japanese cables, only this one asked for specific locations of ships at anchor.
The bomb plot's intelligence specifically asked for the dispositions of the warships and airplanes guarding Pearl Harbor. The obvious intent of the bomb plot's intelligence was to place a grid over Pearl Harbor so that pilots flying in would immediately be able to identify the targets.
American couriers sent the deciphered message to the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Harold Stark, and then to the Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall. Then, according to Hill, the top secret message went to President Roosevelt.
FDR was making all the decisions. Every historian understands that FDR was reading all of the U.S. intelligence decrypts of Japanese coded transmissions.
I know.
Two men in particular could make immediate use of the information. Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, the commanders at Pearl Harbor. But they never received it. According to Hill, that was not an accident.
If FDR and his administration deliberately withheld the vital intelligence from Pearl Harbor, and all the evidence indicates that they did, then it was certainly a deliberate conspiracy to set Pearl Harbor up for a total defeat.
There are other researchers who support Hill's extraordinary hypothesis. They allege the key to understanding exactly what Roosevelt and other officials knew, and at what point they knew it, lies within the United States code-breaking operation.
Breaking the Japanese military codes was America's great secret of World War II.
All agree that, sometime before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. had broken the Japanese diplomatic codes. But in 2000, Robert Stinnett completed almost 20 years of research by publishing his findings, which conclude that America had also cracked the top secret operational codes of the Japanese Navy. According to Stinnett, this proves that Roosevelt's closest military advisors must have known when and where the attack would occur.
The fact that we broke it, we knew what Japan was up to. We knew it before Pearl Harbor. We knew it all through the war. We knew where Japan's ships were going to be, what their plans were to be.
Stinnett's evidence includes two U.S. naval dispatches. In a memo sent in October 1940, over a year before Pearl Harbor, Rear Admiral Royal Ingersoll, the Assistant Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, documented the progress of his code-breaking team. This secret cable to his specific commanders referred to the Japanese naval operational codes. It read, It is estimated that at least 6 months will be required before complete messages can be read.
He said that we had broken the Japanese operations code.
If Ingersoll's timetable was accurate, America should have been able to decrypt secret Japanese naval correspondence by the spring or summer of 1941.
The smoking gun of Pearl Harbor is the breaking of the Japanese naval code, and it's only until recently when I filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Navy that I got these records, and the including the officer in charge who actually broke the code and confirmed that.
That officer in charge was Lieutenant Commander John Leitweiler. He and his 75-man code-breaking team labored inside an impregnable tunnel cut into a mountainside on the island of Corregidor in the Philippines.
Cryptographers would work about 8-hour shifts, then they would have 8 hours off, then they'd come back to work again. But many of them slept right at their desk.
Leitweiler and his staff concentrated on one page at a time, checking all the clues, deciphering page upon page of text, day after day. While researching his book, Stinnett uncovered a second document drafted by Leitweiler, which was received by his superiors in Washington. In it, Stinnett says Leitweiler indicated that his Corregidor team was reading current traffic and had broken the Japanese naval code.
Commander Leitweiler says that he was current in intercepting, decoding, and translating the messages as of November 16, 1941. What more do you need?
Stinnett also maintains that the Japanese fleet, led by Vice Admiral Nagumo, broke radio silence as they steamed towards Pearl Harbor, allowing U.S. interceptors to track the course of the oncoming ships.
The actual evidence that Stinnett has uncovered, that not only did Nagumo break radio silence, but the U.S. Naval listening posts were listening to Nagumo's transmissions and therefore plotting Nagumo's voyage across the Pacific towards Pearl Harbor, only adds credence to the explanation that FDR suppressed here yet another piece of vital intelligence, deliberately kept the commanders at Pearl Harbor in the dark.
That's History Channel Conspiracy, FDR and Pearl Harbor. And you can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com and watch the entire 45-minute History Channel documentary. You can also see the cover of the Hilo Tribune Herald out of Hawaii from the week before Pearl Harbor, November 30th. Pearl Harbor happened on December 7th. You can see the cover of the paper that says, Japan may strike over weekend. So go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for this and all the news. Our next story, daughter of 9/11 pilot killed by fire. This is coming from the New York Times. 5 years after her father's plane crashed in the Pentagon in the September 11th terrorist attacks, a woman was found dead yesterday in a fire at the Galaxy Towers apartment complex in Gutenberg, New Jersey. The woman, Wendy Burlingame, 32, was discovered by firefighters in a short hallway between the kitchen and the bedroom of her 20th floor apartment, where the four-alarm fire began, said Edward DeFazio, the Hudson County prosecutor. Mr. DeFazio said the fire, which law enforcement officials are calling suspicious, began shortly after midnight in the apartment Ms. Burlingame shared with her companion and was still under investigation and was the cause of Ms. Burlingame's death. No one else was injured in the fire, Mr. DeFazio said. Ms. Burlingame was the daughter of Charles F. Burlingame III, a 25-year Navy veteran who was the captain of American Airlines Flight 77, which slammed into the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, killing 189 people. Mr. DeFazio said her companion of 3 years was among several people being interviewed in connection with her death. He would not identify the companion, but tenants in the complex identified him as Kevin Roderick. Sebastian Rojas, 27, lives downstairs from Mr. Roderick. He said that while he did not know Mr. Roderick and Miss Burlingame well, they were real late-night people, whose footsteps and two dogs he heard constantly above his head. The two dogs were also found dead in the home, Mr. DeFazio said. Shortly before the fire erupted, Mr. Rojas said there was louder noises than usual coming from the apartment upstairs, like somebody running around up there, like somebody doing something up there in a rush. Then he said he heard a thud, like somebody dropped something, and 3 or 4 minutes later the building's fire alarm sounded. Mr. Rojas said that within minutes his apartment filled with smoke. He then safely left the building. Lucy Gell, who works at the building's front desk, said that Miss Burlingame was a kind, generous woman with model good looks. She added that Miss Burlingame had brought her down a plate of turkey and mashed potatoes on Thanksgiving, saying that Mr. Roderick was out. Deborah A. Burlingame, Miss Burlingame's aunt, was reached at home before she even knew of her niece's death. She burst into tears on the phone and would not comment further. Miss Burlingame's mother, Nancy Perfect, was also reached at home. She, too, declined to discuss her daughter's death. Now, there are updates on this story that really point to it actually just being a fire and it being an accident. However, it is 9/11 related, so I post most 9/11 related news on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. However, I did get a comment on that story that said, "Why don't you show some respect?" To which I would say to them, "Why don't you send that message to the New York Times? Because they wrote it. I just reposted it." Jumping on big news, actually, this just happened 2 days ago. Both David Lynch and James Brolin on the same day came out with their questions about 9/11. Film director and cult icon David Lynch has gone public with concerns he has over the official government story of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Lynch has stated that he is disturbed by unanswered questions concerning the Pentagon attack, the collapse of the buildings in New York, and the strange ending of Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. Appearing on Dutch television on VPRO's Veldergasten on December 3rd, Lynch discussed and played clips from Dylan Avery's groundbreaking 9/11 documentary, Loose Change.
Do you think it's convincing what I tell in the film?
It's not so much what they say. It's the things that, you know, make you look at what you thought you saw in a different light. And those things for me that bother me is the hole in the Pentagon being too small for a plane, mm-hmm. the lawn isn't mussed up, and the government's not showing the plane hitting when many cameras photographed it. At the World Trade Center, three buildings came down like demolition, and two of them were hit by a plane, but the third one, they said, "Do you want us to pull it?" And they pulled it, and it looked just like the other two. Uh-huh. Those things bother me. In Pennsylvania, the plane that went down, it was just a hole in the ground. There wasn't any wreckage. There wasn't any skid marks. There wasn't any tear in the earth. And no one's ever really found out about that. So every place, there's questions coming from this documentary. And you don't have to believe everything in the documentary to still have questions come up. And you look back and you remember what you saw and what you were told, and now you have questions.
And the event itself, did it change your life or did it change
No.
your view of...
It now it's just an event that has many questions and no answers.
And a suggestion that the American government is behind it?
That's
what does it
too
mean?
Big for people to think about. It's too big.
What do you mean?
It's just, you know, it's like something no one wants to think about.
So that's David Lynch on Dutch television just a few days ago. And on the same day, actor James Brolin, the husband of Barbara Streisand, has today become the latest celebrity figure to publicly question the official story behind 9/11 after he encouraged viewers of a top-rated ABC talk show to check out a 9/11 Truth website. Brolin appeared as a guest on The View Wednesday morning, and according to emails we've been receiving, this is Prison Planet, emails they've been receiving in numbers towards the end of the show, the actor questioned 9/11 and urged the audience to check out the website 911weknow.com, which is a website that purports to expose how the Twin Towers in Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane, were brought down via controlled demolition. Now, the David Lynch thing is big because he's of much higher stature and respected intellectual and artist. However, the James Brolin thing is really interesting because you got basically housewifey kind of people sitting at home watching The View, and old James Brolin comes on and tells them 9/11 was an inside job. So that's awesome, and I've been sending that story around quite a bit. Moving on, I saw just a few nights ago at the Hollywood Theater here in Portland, Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple. And we're going to listen to the trailer here in just a moment, but I'm going to read an article about the film and the events. This is coming from the Washington Post. Why did the followers of cult leader Jim Jones commit mass suicide in Jonestown, Guyana? In Stanley Nelson's Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, the award-winning filmmaker looks at the events leading up to November 18, 1978, when more than 900 People's Temple members drank cyanide-laced Kool-Aid and died en masse. What happened that day is etched in collective memory. Knowing what happened before that changes the picture a bit. The director found a wealth of material on People's Temple and Jones from followers' home movies, photographs, newspapers, and even audio recordings made by Jones and his followers. In fact, the film was inspired by a radio broadcast on the 25th anniversary of the suicide. My wife and I heard some former members of People's Temple on the radio, he says. We were so amazed by the story that they told about how they joined Jones Church to find a racially integrated community and that they'd been able to live out their ideals. That Jones preached racial integration, communal living, and social justice comes as something of a surprise. The church ran well-appointed homes for its elderly members, provided health care for all, and gave its members the sense of being part of a utopian social movement. Nelson interviewed former Jones followers who speak candidly, at times with humor and joy, about their experiences in the church. Ultimately, Nelson says he learned that People's Temple really delivered on a lot of its promises, that people would live in an integrated community, that older people were taken care of. Nelson says he didn't aggressively pursue former Jones followers. I didn't want to play the evil producer and push people into an interview. After all, there are people who have not told their kids and who have not even told their spouses. Jones's fastidious archiving yielded a profusion of material. People's Temple audio recorded everything, Nelson says. There were over 400 audio tapes of Jim Jones preaching all the way up to the last day and the infamous death tape in which Jones implores his followers to go to sleep, to die with a degree of dignity. In the film's final scenes, those who survived the mass suicide because they are away from Jonestown that day or, like Tim Carter and Stanley Clayton, escaped into the jungle afterward, describe losing their family members. In one heartbreaking scene, Carter recounts his wife and son dying in his arms and then says, "They were just fucking slaughtered. There was nothing dignified about it. It had nothing to do with revolutionary suicide. It was just senseless waste." Now, of course, the Washington Post has expletive deleted, but I'm on the internet and I can say it. This story and a lot of links and a lot of information about Jonestown and Jim Jones you can hit up on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. You can even hit a link to the death tape if you're into that sort of thing. But let's listen to the trailer from Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple.
Joins a cult. Nobody joins something they think is going to hurt them. You join a religious organization, you join a political movement, and you join with people that you really like.
I think in everything that I tell you about Jim Jones, there's going to be a paradox. Having this vision to change the world, but having this whole undercurrent of dysfunction that was underneath that vision.
Some people see a great deal of God in my body. They see Christ in me, a hope of glory.
He said, if you see me as your friend, I'll be your friend. As you see me as your father, I'll be your father. He said, if you see me as your God, I'll be your God.
Jim Jones talked about going to the promised land. And then pretty soon we were seeing film footage of Jonestown.
Rice, black-eyed peas, Kool-Aid.
We all wanted to go. I wanted to go.
People's Temple truly had the potential to be something big and powerful and great. And yet, for whatever reason, Jim took the other road.
On the night of the 17th, it was still a vibrant community. I would
never have imagined that 24 hours later they would all be dead.
Die with a degree of dignity. Don't lay down with tears and agony. It's nothing to death, it's just stepping over in another plane. Don't be this way.
Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, is a powerful and disturbing film. It's playing in select theaters. I saw it at the Hollywood Theater a few days ago, and it will actually be broadcast on PBS as part of their American Experience sometime in the next year. You're listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. You can also hit me up, send me an email, MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com. Jumping on to our next story, Bush crime family crony Robert Gates a shoo-in, and we now know that he was a shoo-in, and he has actually been confirmed. But this is coming from Kurt Nemo from a few days ago while the supposed confirmation hearings were going on. Robert Gates, the former CIA director and Texas A&M University president, is expected to easily win nomination as President Bush's next defense secretary following a hearing today that is likely to focus on strategies in Iraq, reports Express News. Easy nomination, no matter the guy is a criminal, not to mention a bloodthirsty, warmongering psychopath. Gates was at the core of the so-called Iran-Contra affair, but then it is business as usual in Washington, as the Bush administration is packed like a sardine tin with Iran-Contra criminals. Lawrence E. Welsh, the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation, knew Gates was lying about his collaboration with fellow criminal, now respected Fox News talking head Oliver North, the guy who wanted to suspend the Constitution and throw demonstrators in gulags under Rex 84. Now, there's a link in this story for Rex 84. If you don't know what Rex 84 is, you should look it up, and it will scare the hell out of you. In 1984, as understudy and protege of then-CIA Director Ghoul William Casey, Gates wanted to bomb the dickens out of Nicaragua. In many ways, Gates is a perfect choice for the neocons. Gates was making it clear to analysts what intelligence they were to produce. Thomas Blanton, director of the NSA, that is the National Security Archive, tells the Los Angeles Times, it's a chilling record because you have two main themes of the Iraq War present in Robert Gates' career at the CIA. The arrogance and bullying of a Rumsfeld and the intelligence cherry-picking of a Cheney. So I encourage you to check out that story and to check out the links and to read about Robert Gates and to see what we're in for, and that we've switched for a Rumsfeld for a Gates. But the crime family and the agenda rolls on. Our next story here on Media Monarchy is called Suspect Nation. This is coming from the BBC. Since Tony Blair's new Labour government came to power in 1997, the UK civil liberties landscape has changed dramatically. ASBOs were introduced by Section 1 of the Crime and Disorder Act of 1998 and first used in 1999. The right to remain silent is no longer universal. Our right to privacy, free from interception of communications, has been severely curtailed. The ability to travel without surveillance or those details of our journeys being retained has disappeared. Indeed, as Henry Porter, the Observer journalist famous for his recent email clash with Tony Blair of the paring down of civil liberties, reveals in this unsettling film that we're about to listen to, our movements are being watched and recorded more than ever before. There are already 4 million CCTV cameras in Britain, the highest number in Europe, and they are becoming ever more sophisticated. It's explained that soon every journey in the UK could be monitored thanks to number plate recognition software. Also, cameras will be able to identify abnormal behavior. For instance, if someone is standing near a cash machine but not using it, software can alert the CCTV operator, which is fine until you stop to consider just what suspicious behavior might entail. Perhaps, as Porter asks, it's time for us to start practicing our normal behavior. Meanwhile, the multi-billion-pound introduction of national identity cards and biometric passports will make it even harder for us to go anywhere or buy anything without leaving an electronic trail of information. The argument in favor of all this increased surveillance and the reduction of our freedoms is that some sacrifices have to be made in order to protect our wider liberties. Tony Blair frequently states that the modern threats posed by terrorism require increasingly sophisticated techniques to catch those who would attack us. Another argument, it is often pointed out, is if we aren't doing anything wrong and we don't have anything to hide, we should have nothing to fear from all this legislation. Porter demolishes this last argument by stating that it's not a question of individuals doing wrong, it's a question of how much we can trust future governments. There is immense potential for future authoritarian regimes to abuse anti-liberty legislation and the huge new supply of information it provides for them. What's more, as Porter shows, these abuses are already happening now. The example he gives is in the USA, where FBI's no-fly lists, supposedly to stop terrorists from getting in planes, were briefly, before the ACLU took the issue to court, extended to include those opposed to government policy. People stopped at airports because of this list included Senator Edward Kennedy and two aging female editors of an anti-war magazine. Porter also blasts the argument about terrorism, first backed up by the former U.S. presidential candidate Al Gore. The film describes how counterproductive all this directionless information gathering can be. In making suspects of us all, our governments are actually making it harder for security forces to target the real troublemakers. We're looking for needles in haystacks, and the Bush-Cheney administration keeps piling more hay on top of the stacks, explains Gore. Secondly, in a triumphant piece of investigative reporting, Porter demonstrates that the new tools that are supposed to fight terrorism could actually make life easier for those that want to hide their true identity. He meets a security expert who demonstrates just how easy it is to crack into the signals given off from CCTV cameras, and by downloading their footage can gain crucial security information from the people they follow. For instance, the cameras can be used to work out security protocols inside buildings. Meanwhile, the chips that will go into ID cards and into our passports contain information that can easily be obtained and potentially duplicated by outside forces. Porter argues that in the not-too-distant future, terrorists will be able to furnish themselves with the perfect alibi and hiding place. They will be able to take the data from the chips we will all be required to carry and become us. Now, there's a lot of links, like most of the stories on Media Monarchy, to a lot of other information, and this story is no different. You can read from Wired about the RFID hacking culture. And so these RFID tags that are going to go into our passports and going to go into our national ID cards are hackable, and you're looking at least identity theft. So we're going to listen to the first little bit of this BBC4 documentary. It's called Suspect Nation, and you're listening to Media Monarchy.
Britain has undergone a huge change in the last few years. Since 9/11, the state has developed a very different view of its citizens. New surveillance technologies are penetrating every aspect of our lives, and we don't even know it. Across the country, millions of cameras are watching us. The police will soon be able to record every journey we make.
Your vehicle has insurance.
Is that address?
Yes, yes.
And soon the state will want all our fingerprints and iris scans.
Please look into the mirror.
The Information Commissioner recently released a report on the Surveillance Society of today. But there is much more to come in the future.
Basically, it's a first and only microchip to implant in humans.
It's like my barcode.
Exactly.
The government says we need all this new technology to fight 21st century crime and terrorism. But far from making life safer, it could actually help those we fear most.
Here's a new passport. That's the actual chip that will have your data stored on it.
Yeah.
Full name, date of birth, yes. Nationality, and so on. I've written some software that will actually try and read it.
It's unbelievable.
Now has powers to probe and pry into our lives that the dictatorships of the past couldn't have dreamt of. A profound change is taking place, and we should all be worried that we are sleepwalking into a society where 24-hour surveillance of everyone is the norm.
I recently accepted an offer to engage in an email correspondence about surveillance and civil liberties with Tony Blair, which was published in the Observer newspaper. The Prime Minister dismissed concerns about civil liberties, arguing the increased dangers posed by crime and terrorism justified the government's approach. He wrote, We are trying to fight 21st century crime by 19th century means. It hasn't worked. It won't work. The terrorism is different. The street crime is different. In this program, I want to find out more about the actual technology of surveillance. What is already in use, how it is being used, and what is planned for the future. And most importantly, what the consequences are for us, the citizens of this democracy. And this is where it starts.
This is one of 4 million CCTV cameras in Britain. That's more than anywhere else in Europe. In the last 15 years, Britain has become the CCTV capital of the world.
There's no doubt that cameras can deal with some crime effectively. For instance, they significantly reduce crime in car parks, which is one of the reasons the current government spent £170 million on CCTV when it came to power. Today, they are everywhere. On the street, in shops, in restaurants and bars, even on buses and taxis. And the footage is normally held for 30 days.
I just did a little experiment. I walked from this concourse down through the station, down to the gents' loo, and counted 31 cameras.
Professor Clive Norris estimates that people in London are filmed an average of 300 times a day.
What we've moved away from is this idea, in a sense, that you should only target those that you have reasonable suspicion of, and we've moved to a point where we're saying everybody is suspicious and we have a right to target everybody.
It's a fundamental change in our society when everyone becomes a suspect, doesn't it?
I think this is the major drift in the last 15 years. When we talk about the move to the risk society, what it actually means is we are all a risk, therefore we must all be monitored.
Not just monitored, but judged. London Underground has recently been testing out some remarkable new software created by a British company called Ipsotech, which will analyse CCTV footage. Using a pre-programmed profile, the software will decide if what the camera is seeing is normal or abnormal. The makers claim it will identify potential criminals by their behaviour. For example, if someone is standing near a cash machine but not using it, the software will alert the CCTV operator. Perhaps it's time for us to start practicing our normal behavior. In response to the increase in surveillance, the government has introduced laws intended to give us greater access to our personal data, including CCTV footage. Heather Brook is a journalist specializing in data protection law and the Freedom of Information Act. She believes that in practice, these laws are failing to deliver what they promise.
It's a one-way system where they're demanding all this information from us, and yet, on the other hand, they're not giving it back.
But what would... I mean, you know, I would say this to people, and I've often written this sort of thing, and people tend to say, but what can I do? This is the way life is, this is the way technology is, and there's nothing I can do, I can't protest. What can they do?
I guess the simplest thing they could do is use their right to ask for the footage.
Yeah.
And
how do they do that?
What they do is they make a request, a sort of subject access request, and you use the Data Protection Act.
Yes.
And you ask the authority who owns the camera for the footage of you.
Yes.
We decided to put these freedom of information laws to the test. There are hundreds of cameras around the Houses of Parliament and Ministry of Defence. Well, it's one of the most important and sensitive areas in Britain. So the high security is to be expected.
Was it actually four?
This is Channel 4.
Channel 4, was it a documentary or...?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's all I wanted to know, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Then I stood outside a bank for a few minutes being watched. I can understand the reasons for them needing security as well. Just around the corner is a football association. Even they have cameras that film anyone who passes. It's difficult to imagine why they feel they need cameras anywhere but on the pitch. And what's happening to all this material? How long is it stored? How can it be used? Heather prepared letters filed under the Data Protection Act, requesting access to some of the footage. I'll soon find out whether the promise of the Data Protection Act is fulfilled in practice or not. In the last few years, software has been available to allow computers to read car number plates. This automatic number plate recognition technology is used in speed cameras and on a huge scale to enforce a congestion charge in London.
Go ahead. Number. Robbie Uniform 04 Tango Zulu Golf. Your vehicle has insurance.
At that address?
Yes, yes.
Now it's been developed further and has been linked to the vast police national computer database. Here in South London, it's been used to check every vehicle that passes, up to 60 cars a minute. The number plates are instantaneously checked against the national computer for theft, insurance irregularities, unpaid fines, or suspected criminal activity. Patrols a few hundred meters away are waiting to pick up the suspects. 23 police forces across England and Wales are now using this technology in high crime areas.
What's a big impact for you?
In that time, essentially for us, it's about denying criminals the use of the roads and increasing road safety. And so the kind of vehicles that we capture will be involved in crime, general crime. So we have caught people who are wanted for murder, people who are involved in serious crime, people who have got weapons and firearms within their vehicle.
But the police have far greater plans for this technology.
One of the troubling things about this new surveillance society of ours is something known as function creep. A piece of technology is brought in for one reason, but then used for far more.
London's congestion charge system has 700 cameras, which use number plate recognition. It is designed to charge people who drive into the centre of town during peak times. But, in an example of function creep, the police want to link these existing cameras with the police national computer. And it isn't just London. A reported 3,000 cameras are currently being installed in a nationwide rollout of number plate recognition systems. And they won't just be monitoring criminals. The system will log the time, date and location of every car which passes its cameras. A national computer centre will scan up to 35 million number plates every day and keep the information for 2 years. And the police want to extend that to five.
One of the really astonishing things is that despite the serious implications for privacy and individual liberty, these measures were never debated in Parliament.
We were waiting for a response to our request for CCTV footage. But I also want to know more about the cameras used in London for the congestion charge.
I've got two more requests that should be coming through at the end of this week. The one about the congestion charge cameras.
I'm very interested in that.
These
are the cameras which, when the congestion charge is not in operation, they're still filming and collecting your number plate. Why are they doing that?
I have no idea. I've asked them for the hours of operation, and then I've asked if these are operating out of the congestion charge time period. Why? What's the policy on why they're running, and what's done with that data as well?
Yeah.
What's the purpose of collecting that data?
So we're checked on the roads and watched on the streets. What about the tube? Transport for London has been very active in promoting Oyster cards. And why not? They're convenient, easy to use, and if you have one, you get a 50% discount.
Or is it the case that you get penalised if you don't have one? You may not know this, but having an Oyster card gives London Transport a complete record of every single journey you make.
Every trip you've taken in the last 8 weeks has been recorded in a database. The time, the start and finish points, all linked directly to your name and address. So now, there can be a record of your movements as you walk, drive and travel on the tube. Whatever next?
Please look into the mirror. Please move back a little.
From 2009, we will need to have our biometric data recorded if we want one of the Prime Minister's ID cards. He says they will be key in fighting everything from terrorism to illegal immigration.
Please look into the mirror. Please look into the mirror.
With Paranoia Attack. I was lucky enough to go see them Sunday night at the Roseland. Paranoia Attack's off their last record, Wet From Birth. My name's James. Welcome to the second hour of Media Monarchy, coming to you on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Moving on and moving fast, our next story, Blair unveils plan for nuclear missiles. And this is coming from the AP. Prime Minister Tony Blair launched plans Monday for a new multi-billion dollar submarine-based nuclear missile defense system, warning lawmakers the future may hold perilous threats from rogue regimes and state-sponsored terrorists. In what is expected to be among his last major Axis premiere, Blair told the House of Commons that despite the end of the Cold War, potential threats were posed by North Korea, Iran, and others. In these circumstances, it would be unwise and dangerous for Britain alone of any of the nuclear powers to give up its independent nuclear deterrent, he said. Blair said Britain would cut back on its stock of nuclear warheads from 200 to 160, a move intended to make the proposal more acceptable to detractors within his own party. But he said any decision to reduce the nuclear-armed submarine fleet from 4 to 3 would be made only after a new vessel is designed. Blair said advisors had ruled out land or air-based alternatives as too costly and too vulnerable. The existing submarine fleet will be phased out from 2022, defense officials said. Our next story is Bolton resigns, one more neocon down. Coming from AP and MSNBC, unable to win Senate confirmation, UN Ambassador John Bolton will step down when his temporary appointment expires within weeks, the White House said Monday. Bolton's nomination has languished in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for more than a year, blocked by Democrats and several Republicans. Senator Lincoln Chafee, a moderate Republican who lost in the midterm elections November 7th that swept Democrats to power in both houses of Congress, was adamantly opposed to Bolton. Critics have questioned Bolton's brusque style and whether he could be an effective bureaucrat who could force reform at the UN. President Bush gave Bolton the job temporarily in August 2005 while Congress was in recess. Under that process, the appointment expires when Congress formally adjourns no later than early January. The White House resubmitted Bolton's nomination last month, but with Democrats capturing control of the next Congress, his chances of winning confirmation appeared slight. The incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Democratic Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, said he saw, quote, no point in considering Mr. Bolton's nomination again. Now from bastards going down to men of the people coming up, coming from Reuters, Chavez storms to re-election victory. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez stormed to a re-election victory in Sunday's vote, handing him an ample mandate to broaden his promised socialist revolution and challenge Washington's influence in Latin America. Dressed in his signature red shirt, Chavez told cheering supporters at his presidential palace late Sunday his landslide was a blow to U.S. President George W. Bush's administration, which portrays the leftists as an anti-democratic menace. Today we gave another lesson in dignity to the imperialists. It is another defeat for the empire of Mr. Danger, Chavez roared from a balcony above the crowds using one of the insults he had tossed to the U.S. president. The former soldier's victory will further rile the White House, which worries about Chavez destabilizing Latin American neighbors and strengthening ties between the OPEC heavyweight Venezuela and U.S. foes Cuba and Iran. The National Electoral Council said Chavez won 61% of the vote, while rival Manuel Rosales, a governor of an oil-producing province who managed to unite the fractured opposition, won 38% after nearly 80% of the vote had been counted. Chavez supporters fired off thunderous fireworks in the capital and drove through Caracas chanting, "Hey ho, Chavez will not go," to celebrate his securing six more years in office. Our next story is coming from theonlinejournal.com, and it's written by a great writer and reporter named Jerry Mazza, and you should look up more of his articles. Some of them are posted on mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. His latest story, Greenberg Buying Up New York Times Shares. Hammer and Hank, as he's better known to colleagues, is at it again. According to Reuters, AP, and CNBC at MSN.money, Maurice Hank Greenberg has been buying up shares of the New York Times Company to try to break the Sulzberger family's hold on it. Watch out. As you may remember, Greenberg resigned as CEO from the board of AIG, American Insurance Group, in February 2005 and left the company on March 14th following regulatory inquiries made by Attorney General Spitzer, recently elected New York governor. Subsequently, AIG and its new CEO, Martin Sullivan, paid a fine of over $1.6 billion. Greenberg's former satellite firm, Marsh & McLennan Companies, the world's largest insurance broker, was run by Hank's son, Jeffrey Greenberg, from 1993 to 2004. Jeffrey left 11 days after Spitzer's civil action against MMC was presented on October 14, 2004. In January 2005, Marsh was forced to pay $850 million in fines to policyholders for steering clients to insurers from which it received lucrative payoffs. Both Greenberg Sr. and Jeffrey Greenberg are Council on Foreign Relations members. By the way, Marsh also bought Kroll, the security and military contracting company that recently pulled out of Iraq. Just a bit of backstory about the Greenberg familia. There's more linked in my September 29th article in Online Journal, and there's more in my October 9th article, Answering the Mail, R.E. Greenberg and the AIG. In it, there is a notable quote by Michael Rupert from The Wilderness. From the Wilderness has also conducted an extensive investigation into AIG and its predecessors, including the CV Star insurance companies, revealing deep connections to U.S. intelligence dating back to the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, in World War II. These connections include documented CIA operatives connected to drug smuggling from Southeast Asia and a current board member, Frank Wisner Jr., whose father was a key figure in the creation of the CIA. History, as well as AIG's current operations, suggest that these relationships continue unabated today. Still coming from the Wilderness, Michael Rupert, AIG has also been connected, albeit indirectly, to a major money laundering case. As the insurance carrier for the Bank of New York, they are defending Bank of New York in a suit filed this year by Bank of New York shareholders charging mismanagement of the bank. That suit arose from revelations in the major media that Bank of New York had been involved in laundering between $7 and $10 billion in criminal money out of Russia during the 1990s under its chairman, Thomas Renyi. Credible sources told me, but I have not been able to confirm it, that AIG also insures the U.S. Department of Justice, which was charged with investigating Bank of New York and which decided not to file criminal charges in 1999. You have to ask yourself, with a background and resume like this, is this man qualified to own and run a major newspaper? And, if given his druthers, is he also fit to make a bid for the Tribune Company, which owns, among others, the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, and a host of TV stations? He has sold more than $1.5 billion in AIG shares since May. The articles report it would seem he has some cash in hand for buying. Do we need another Rupert Murdoch, eager to envelop and steer more media to the right? Do we need Maurice Greenberg, a man who grew out of a corporate culture with long-standing affiliation to the OSS and CIA, an insurance company reputedly involved in money laundering and drug smuggling while operating conveniently in some 135 countries? What's more, Greenberg has some help in his Times Company plans for Morgan Stanley, which submitted a proposal to the Times Company that is aimed at cutting the Sulzberg family's long-standing control of the company by changing the voting structure so that shareholders have equal voting rights. It would seem that such an act would compromise the Times Company's editorial content, given a block of voters a single large share block voter who might choose to interfere in policy. Additionally, AIG, Greenberg, and Morgan Stanley share another tie mentioned in my article, The Promise of 9/11 and Beyond. I think the opening paragraph underscores a darker side of AIG and Morgan Stanley business. As whistleblower Richard Grove points out, Silverstream, the software company he worked for at the time of 9/11, served not only AIG, it also built trading applications for Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, Alex Brown, Morgan Stanley, and Marsh & McLennan. With this impressive list, according to Grove, you pretty much had the major players involved in the financial aspect of the 9/11 fraudulent trading activity. Thus, every fiber in me smells a rat in this alliance. Let me add, too, I am a New York Times reader, online and off. I don't think it's a perfect newspaper. I prefer alternative media. But I respect its right to be, and not to be interfered with by the likes of Maurice Greenberg or Morgan Stanley or any of the brokerage firms listed above. The news, and whatever truth the Times brings, should not be for sale to these power brokers. Thank you, I'll take the Sulzbergers. And that's another great article from Jerry Mazza and OnlineJournal.com. You're listening to Media Monarchy, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com and MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. Our next story is so big, it's really kind of tiny, actually. And I had given you the heads up, I think, on the episode before the last election to watch to see if they would drop this DoubleTree video right before the election showing a plane hitting the Pentagon. The video has actually finally been released. And what does it show? It shows a blast, but virtually nothing else.
We're at a hotel in Arlington, Virginia. It shows the explosion that followed the crash of American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon, but the video does not show the airplane. The video's existence was disclosed in 2002. A hotel manager says it was confiscated by the FBI. It was just publicly released as the result of a lawsuit.
Now you can watch that little bit of CNN headline news on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. CNN was the only place that I saw any reportage other than 9/11 alternative media that gave this any bit of coverage, and the story didn't even get its own page. It was just one of those pages where they throw a bunch of news together. It had about 20 different news stories, but I cut it out and posted it on Media Monarchy. So coming from CNN, this is what you just heard. A hotel security camera video released by the U.S. government showed the explosion that followed the crash of American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, but the low-quality recording did not capture an image of the 757 jetliner. The video, recorded by security cameras at the DoubleTree Hotel in Arlington, was released to public interest group Judicial Watch and others who filed a lawsuit seeking the tape and other videos from that day. CNN filed a Freedom of Information request for the video in February 2002 after the manager of the hotel disclosed its existence to CNN senior Pentagon correspondent Jamie McIntyre and said it had been confiscated by the FBI. CNN's FOIA request was denied because at the time the tape was considered evidence in the investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui, who has since been convicted. There was speculation that this video might show the American Airlines 757 jetliner before it crashed, but a close examination by CNN only revealed the subsequent explosion and no image of the jet. The only known record of the plane is on images from the Pentagon security camera, first broadcast by CNN in March 2002 and officially released in their entirety May of this year. When they say officially released in their entirety, they mean basically all five frames of video that the Pentagon has given us that show nothing other than an incorrect date stamp and a big fiery explosion. Our next story, Calderon sworn in amid chair tossing, and this is actually coming from the Taipei Times. President Felipe Calderon laid out plans to fight crime and keep Mexicans from migrating abroad for work after taking the oath of office amid catcalls and jeers that reflected deep divisions over his narrow electoral victory. In an apparent reference to the brawls and chair tossing on the floor of Congress, where leftist lawmakers tried but failed to block his inauguration on Friday, Calderon said, "I am aware of the seriousness of our differences, and I fully assume my responsibility to resolve them and reunify Mexico." That may be a tall order. His former rival, leftist Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, egged on protests by demonstrators and lawmakers throughout the day. Tackling Mexico's challenges may be equally tough, and Calderon acknowledged that the country is racked by violent crime, killings, and kidnappings that are often driven by battles between rival drug gangs. "Today, crime is trying to terrify and immobilize the public and the government," Calderon told a friendlier crowd in a speech before invited guests at a Mexico City concert hall. "The lack of public safety threatens everybody and has become the main problem of whole states, cities, and regions." A lawyer by training, Calderon said he would come up with a plan within 90 days to improve law enforcement, though he stopped short of promising simple solutions. "It won't be easy or quick. It will take time and a lot of money and even, unfortunately, lives," he said. "But rest assured, this is a battle that I will lead." He added that next week he will announce cuts to the presidential salary and those top officials and repeated his campaign pledge to create jobs to stem outward migration. "Instead of workers leaving to look for U.S. investment, it would be better for that investment to come to where the workers are so that our families and communities are no longer divided," he said. The 44-year-old career politician said he is prepared to negotiate with the opposition, but warned, "I won't wait for dialogue before going to work. The people are ready for action." Minutes before Calderon's arrival at Congress for the swearing-in, lawmakers threw chairs and shoved one another to the floor to gain control of the hall, with Lopez Obrador's supporters trying to block the ceremony. But visiting foreign dignitaries seemed to take it in stride. "It's good action," quipped California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who attended, along with former U.S. President George Bush, Texas Governor Rick Perry, and several sitting presidents. "That seems to me to be a natural progression in a democratic society," Perry said. "People are feeling comfortable about expressing their opinion and what have you, so I was pretty excited about a little fisticuffs, a little protest." Later on Friday, Calderon had lunch with Mexican political and business leaders and met with a group of Central American leaders to discuss development plans and propose a regional summit on the issue for next year. Calderon also met with Spanish Prince Felipe of Asturias and British Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott, the government news agency Notamex said. Fox stood by Calderon's side at the inaugural ceremony, then took an Air Force helicopter to his ranch in central Mexico, where he plans to retire. The first opposition president in 71 years, Fox largely disappointed voters who believed his promises of millions of new jobs and prosperity. Calderon was conciliatory during his speech at the National Auditorium, saying, "To those who voted for others, I will not ignore your causes. I ask you to let me win over your confidence." There's a lot of links in that story on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. Our next one is a real pisser. U.S. government terror ratings draw outrage. This is coming from the AP. A leader of the new Democratic Congress, business travelers, and privacy advocates expressed outrage last Friday over the unannounced assignment of terrorism risk assessments to American international travelers by a computerized system managed from an unmarked two-story brick building in Northern Virginia. Incoming Senate Judiciary Chairman Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont pledged greater scrutiny of such government database mining projects after reading that during the past 4 years, millions of Americans have been evaluated without their knowledge to assess the risks that they are terrorists or criminals. "Databanks like this are overdue for oversight," said Leahy, who will take over Judiciary in January. "That is going to change in the new Congress." The AP reported last Thursday that Americans and foreigners crossing U.S. borders since 2002 have been assessed by the Homeland Security Department's Computerized Automated Targeting System, or ATS. And there's a link there, and you can read a lot more about that. The travelers are not allowed to see or directly challenge these risk assessments, which the government intends to keep on file for 40 years. Some or all data in the system can be shared with state, local, and foreign governments for use in hiring, contracting, and licensing decisions. Courts and even some private contractors can obtain some of the data under certain circumstances. "It is simply incredible that the Bush administration is willing to share this sensitive information with foreign governments and even private employers while refusing to allow U.S. citizens to see or challenge their own terror scores," Leahy said. "This system highlights the danger of government use of technology to conduct widespread surveillance of our daily lives without proper safeguards or privacy." Yeah, that should piss you off. Our next story was one that I would have covered last week, but I missed last week, but it's still pertinent, and it's still valuable, and it's still important, and we're still going to cover it. Three people, three letters, one target, RFK. This is coming from BBC Newsnight. New video and photographic evidence that puts three senior CIA operatives at the scene of Robert Kennedy's assassination have been brought to light. The evidence was shown in a report by Shane O'Sullivan, broadcast on BBC Newsnight. It reveals that the operatives and four unidentified associates were at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles in the moments before and after the shooting on June 5, 1968. The CIA had no domestic jurisdiction, and some of the officers were based in Southeast Asia at the time, with no reason to be in Los Angeles. Coming from "The Truth Will Set You Free," it all makes sense. JFK, MLK, RFK, and anyone else who could stand in the way of the ruthless struggle to have it all. This is the handiwork of America's not-so-secret government. But how do you stop people who stop at nothing to get what they want and who openly operate behind closed doors? There's only one way. Keep exposing them, demand change, and pray for a miracle. Now we're going to listen to this BBC Newsnight broadcast and the Shane O'Sullivan report.
Kennedy would have been 81 today, instead of which he was killed in one of the most famous political assassinations of modern American history. A Palestinian man, Sirhan Sirhan, was seized, charged, tried, and convicted. Nearly 40 years on, he's still in jail, repeatedly denied parole. The violent deaths of prominent people, whether they be Bobby Kennedy's brother, JFK, or even Diana, Princess of Wales, routinely attract conspiracy theories. But that wasn't uppermost in the mind of Shane O'Sullivan when he began to look into the assassination. There's some strong language in his film.
One thing is clear in this year of 1968, I believe in this country as I traveled across, and that is that the American people want no more Vietnams.
In August in Chicago, the Democratic Party will nominate its candidate for President of the United States. There are two roads to that nomination. One is to seek commitments through discussions with political leaders. The other is to go to the people.
June 5th, 1968, the Ambassador Hotel, Los Angeles. Bobby Kennedy wins the California Democratic primary and is tipped to beat Nixon to the White House.
I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of next year. Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you.
Moments later, he is assassinated while leaving through a kitchen pantry.
Close the door! Shoot it!
Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot in the head.
It's only 2 months since the assassination of Martin Luther King. Twenty-four-year-old Palestinian Sirhan Sirhan is seen firing at Kennedy and is arrested as the lone assassin. But for nearly 40 years, debate has raged over whether a second gunman was involved. Police diagrams based on the autopsy show the fatal shot came from behind, but witnesses place Sirhan's gun several feet in front of Kennedy.
The actual shooter of Robert Kennedy was standing behind Robert Kennedy, according to the autopsy report. Sirhan was standing in front of him, face to face. The distance between the muzzle of the assailant's weapon and Robert Kennedy's body was somewhere between actual contact and no more than 3 inches. And the weapon from which the shots were fired was held at a sharp upward angle, again from the rear. All the witnesses state that Sirhan's weapon was held between 1.5 and 6 feet away from Robert Kennedy, horizontally, in relation to the floor. The autopsy report exonerates Sirhan.
Behind me is the famous Ambassador Hotel, where Robert Kennedy was assassinated that night. It's now a construction site, shortly to be a high school project in memory of Bobby Kennedy. I started writing a screenplay 3 years ago based on this case, fascinated by the conspiracy theories. During the course of my research, I found new video and photographs that suggested 3 CIA operatives were at the hotel that night, and I believe involved in the assassination.
Agent number 1, the Indian man in the white shirt at the back of the room, moments after the speech and just before the shooting. I think this man is David Morales. Moments after the shooting, agent number 2, Gordon Campbell, walks from the direction of the pantry with a small container in his hand, as a Latin man waves him towards an exit. 30 minutes after the shooting, here is Agent 1 again, David Morales. I also found several photographs of these agents earlier in the evening. Here, Agent 2, Gordon Campbell, stands in the ballroom hours before the shooting with a third agent. These officers worked together in 1963 at JM Wave, the CIA's Miami base for its secret war on Castro. Bradley Ayers worked with these men. I traveled to the other side of the country to meet up with a man who worked in covert operations in the 60s and was at the Ambassador Hotel that night.
Are you staying on the time?
David Rayburn had been shown the photograph of Morales and remembered seeing him there.
Do you think that's the same man that you saw in the photograph?
Oh, yeah. That's him.
I didn't see him in the ballroom. I saw him out in the lobby area. In fact, I probably saw him several times. He was in and out.
I just want you to have a look at this photograph. The two men in the center. This photograph was taken, I think, a couple of hours before the assassination. So I'm just looking at the two figures here in the middle. I just wonder if you saw either of those men that night.
This man here, the bald one,
yeah,
I think he was talking to Morales at one time. It's like he was standing talking to him.
If Campbell was the man on the left of the photograph, who is the guy on the right? I went back to the East Coast to meet a lawyer at Cornell University, Ed Lopez. In 1978, he was a 23-year-old investigator for the Congressional Committee looking into the JFK assassination. I thought he might know our third man.
Let me just take you back a minute. Here we were, a Congressional Committee, investigating who might have killed a president back in 1963. As you know, the majority of the American public at the time thought there had been a conspiracy.
The man the CIA called out of retirement to work as their liaison to the House Select Committee on Assassinations was George Joannides. He never disclosed he worked as chief of psychological warfare operations at the CIA's Miami base in 1963.
I saw George Joannides practically every day for months. George Joannides was the guy who was supposed to be our point person. But when we got down to work, he was all business. What we could see, what we couldn't see, why we could see something, why we couldn't see something, why it was redacted, why it wasn't redacted.
Let me now show you a photograph that was taken in the Ambassador Hotel the night Robert Kennedy died. And I'd like you to look at the figure on the right center frame.
Well, when I look at this picture, the guy is young and in shape, always standing, stands erect. It's the way I remember him being. The glasses, his hair slightly receding. At the time, it was dark. By the time that I got to meet him, it was graying. But it's just, you just look at him and you say, this is the guy that I spent many hours with at Langley. This is George Joannides.
Not everyone I spoke to could identify our three CIA agents. I interviewed Tom Clines and Ed Wilson, both former agents and close colleagues of David Morales. They said I and all the others were mistaken, but they weren't willing to go on camera. Could there be an innocent explanation for the presence of these three CIA agents at the Ambassador Hotel that night?
Is David Morales a suitable figure to protect Bobby Kennedy?
No. No, I mean, in my wildest imagination, I couldn't imagine assigning David Morales to protect any of the Kennedys.
Suspicion? High suspicion. Yes. I can't deny that. So... why they were doing the things that they were doing, I'm surprised that was never investigated.
What do you think needs to be done now?
Well, I think the key people at the CIA need to go back to anybody who might have been around back then, bring them in, and interview them. Ask, is this Gordon Campbell? Is this George Joannides? Did you know about any operation going on? If you didn't, then why the hell were they there?
After so many interviews and some conflicting testimony, my gut feeling is that still these three senior CIA operatives were the men behind the assassination. Who were these men and why were they at the hotel that night? The CIA and the Los Angeles Police Department owe the public an explanation before the truth behind the Robert Kennedy assassination is lost to history.
There are some who talk about my youth. It is true I am younger than many who have run for president and older than many of those who founded this country. Whatever my years, however, I would gladly match my experience with that of others who have aspired to the presidency. And after all, we are still a young country.
If you'd like to watch that film again, it's on our website. Do tell us whether you're convinced by the identifications. Shana Sullivan, who is the author of that piece, is with us here now. This is a long way from conclusive proof mm-hmm. that these guys were up to anything bad there, if indeed they're even the right people.
Well, I guess all we're doing is asking the question. You know, we're suggesting that we have positive identification on these three CIA operatives who worked at JM Wave in 1963.
Although there were two other ex-CIA people who denied them.
Yes, so we have strong independent verification from people who weren't CIA, and then we have a couple of CIA agents who say it's not Morales.
Does it strike you as odd that 40 years almost after the event, you're the first person to make this connection?
Well, the archive was actually there all along. The LAPD made a 20-minute film of newsreel of the assassination, and they missed the Campbell clip that we've just seen in the film that we've done. So that's just one indication that they looked in a lot of places, but they didn't look in the correct places during the original investigation.
Now, formally, I believe the CIA have said what about these guys? They say they don't comment.
You know, I mean, the comment you'd expect, that they can't go into previous operatives' identities, and that also they have no domestic jurisdiction. So the question that we're asking is, we have interviewed various people who knew these men well. They say that they're the men in the photographs, so we're asking the CIA and the Los Angeles Police Department to address that question. You know, is this the men we think they are, and why are they there?
Why do you think they were there?
Well, I don't think there's any credible explanation for why they would be there if they are CIA operatives, and that's the question that we're trying to clear up. They wouldn't have been Kennedy's security if you know the men's backgrounds. They'd have professed hatred of the Kennedys. Morales made the comment that we listened to, that he was in Dallas in 63 and Los Angeles in 68.
You don't get any anxiety about potential libel suits?
Well, we know that Morales died in 1978, just weeks before he was due to be called before the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Janitas died in 1990. Gordon Campbell may still be out there. So, yeah, a libel suit is a possibility, but then we also would have discovery in terms of showing how important this material is.
Assuming there is much more to it than the straight Sirhan story, do you think we'll ever get to the bottom of it?
I think it's important that we do. I mean, there's a guy called Paul Schrade who was walking behind Kennedy on the night, and he was shot in the head, and he's been one of the leading campaigners to reopen the case for years because of the second gun theory and various doubts that there have been around. So I think this evidence is quite important because it's the first time that we've actually showed a CIA presence.
Three people, three letters, one target. RFK, and that's a BBC Newsnight report, and it's posted on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. You're listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. You can also send me an email, MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com. Our next story, coming from that invaluable resource of 9/11-related news, 9/11 Blogger. New Eminem track references wiretaps, assassinations, and 9/11. A track entitled Public Enemy No. 1 on Eminem's upcoming mixtape The Re-Up caught my ear this afternoon. The track features a simple, almost militant-style beat somewhat similar in tone to his last politically motivated track, Mosh. While Mosh, which New York Magazine called the most important piece of mainstream dissent since the 60s, alluded to 9/11 via caricatures of Bush reading My Pet Goat, and newspaper clippings on 9/11, including the infamous Bush New New York Post article. This new track goes into much darker aspects. While Eminem is not known for being a 9/11 skeptic, and he has not overtly stated that he is one, there is plenty to suggest that he is at least a questioner of the official story. Not only does this track and the Mosh track reference 9/11, but his former DJ, Green Lantern, had the track Bin Laden by Immortal Technique and Mos Def, which you heard on a previous episode of Media Monarchy, alongside tracks by Eminem and other members of Shady Records. There are other past references to 9/11, as well as such mockery of Bin Laden speaking to a camera and having the backdrop fall down and reveal Dick Cheney and other members of the Bush administration. Most of these references have been scattered about so far, but perhaps that will change soon. This is not Eminem's new album. It is a mixtape for his label, Shady Records, but it may give an idea as to what direction Eminem will go in on his next solo album, or at least we can hope. One thing for certain is, if he did go down this direction further in the future, he most assuredly would become Public Enemy number one. We can check out the song, post some thoughts, and check out the large 9/11-related hip-hop section on 911podcast.com. And we're going to listen to the Eminem track, Public Enemy No. 1.
Hello? What up? Hello? Yo, I can't hear you. Let me call you right back.
I think someone's tapping into my phone's wire. run the A when we drop to Atlanta, when we drop to Atlanta.
Eminem, Public Enemy number one, and you can listen to that track on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. Moving on and moving quickly, our next story, Cheney, Rockefeller, and the Council on Foreign Relations. There's a little clip. I think it actually originates from a John Birch Society video, but info is info. So it's posted up on YouTube, and it's posted up on Media Monarchy, and one of the comments, I believe, by the poster of this video says, Dick Cheney is a traitor, an evil and wicked man, yet the foolish and damned conservatives are seduced to believe him to be a God-fearing Christian when he is anything but. Here we see him admit to his dishonesty. What a shame unto the foolish of the Republic who constantly refuse to see their leaders for who they are and even admit to being.
A special televised meeting of the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations provides a window to the real story. The speaker, Vice President Dick Cheney, takes a question from David Rockefeller.
Vice President, I just enjoyed so much your whole speech, but I was particularly pleased that you gave such a strong endorsement for the free trade agreement for all the Americas, subject that has been of great concern to me for many years, and particularly recently, and I think it's absolutely essential for the strength of our economy.
Rockefeller's role in the drive for an FTAA was a lot more central than he portrays. Rockefeller cultivated Latin American leaders who could be counted on to support such a proposal. Both the 1994 Miami Summit and the FTAA proposal were conceived and nurtured by a Rockefeller-created network. Prominent among the organizations sponsoring the Miami event were the Council of the Americas, founder and honorary chairman David Rockefeller, the Americas Society, chairman David Rockefeller, the Forum of the Americas, founder David Rockefeller, the Institute for International Economics, financial backer and board member David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission, founder and honorary chairman David Rockefeller. Rockefeller's influence also extends to the current administration. He was chairman emeritus of the CFR when Vice President Dick Cheney once served as a director, a relationship that Cheney concealed during his congressional career.
It's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming.
There's Mr. Cheney admitting that he was a director of the Council on Foreign Relations and admitting that he lied to his constituents. We're going to move from that creepy story to a funny and scary story. CNN demands Representative Ellison prove he's not an enemy combatant. This may be Daily Show material, but it is decidedly not funny. This is extremely dangerous ground the media is treading. At this pace, within a year, they'll be rounding up Muslims across America and shipping them over to Halliburton's prefab detention centers.
But enough about the war in Iraq. There's also a battle being waged to protect our homeland. Because the army can't be everywhere, it's up to concerned citizens, like CNN's Glenn Beck, to spot possible enemy combatants, like Keith Ellison, a newly minted Minnesota representative and the first Muslim ever elected to U.S. Congress.
No offense, and I know Muslims, I like Muslims, I've been to mosques.
This is not going to end well.
I have to tell you, I have been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And I know you're not. I'm not accusing you of being an enemy, but that's the way I feel, and I think a lot of Americans will feel that way.
Finally! A guy who says what people who aren't thinking are thinking. The congressman stuck to his guns. Not that he has guns.
There's no one who is more patriotic than I am, and so you know I don't need to prove my patriotic stripes.
And I'm not asking you to.
I'm just asking you to. Just like as a conservative white guy, the burden is on me to prove to you I've neither blown up a federal building with a fertilizer bomb nor sucked off a gay hooker in the men's room of a Denny's.
I'm gonna tell all you
Billy Bragg and Wilco, with thanks to Mr. Woody Guthrie. All you fascists, you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. My name's James, and we're rapidly hurtling towards our conclusion of this, our fifth episode of Media Monarchy. So let me try and rush through a bunch of the news that I haven't been able to hit, and will probably not be able to go further back in time as we progress further into the future. RIAA legal ruling could shut down the Internet. U.S. government supports legal case that would criminalize making any files available on the World Wide Web. This is coming from the hardworking folks at Prison Planet. A landmark legal case on behalf of the Recording Industry Association of America and other global trade organizations seeks to criminalize all Internet file sharing of any kind as copyright infringement, effectively shutting down the World Wide Web, and their argument is supported by the U.S. government. Ray Beckerman, a lawyer representing clients in cases against the RIAA, recently took part in a conference call organized by DefectiveByDesign.org, an organization which opposes DRM, that's Digital Rights Management Technology, content-restricting programs embedded into software that blocks users' access to music, movies, software, and other forms of digital data. Beckerman describes how the Internet users are randomly targeted by the RIAA for simply having a folder of music on their computer, kept in the dark about legal details, and intimidated into paying thousands of dollars immediately or facing a federal lawsuit. The RIAA doesn't even attempt to prove copyright infringement with specific cases, dates, or times. It simply coerces and threatens the victim until they relent into paying out huge settlement fees. In one case, UMG versus Linder, a cleaner who has never used or owned a computer but simply dusted near one, was sued as an online distributor in peer-to-peer file sharing, accusing the RIAA of conducting a reign of terror by bringing lawsuits against defenseless people. Beckerman warned that one case in particular, Electra versus Barker, has the potential to shut down the Internet completely. RIAA's argument is that Ms. Barker, a poor nursing student who lives in housing projects, should be prosecuted on the basis that merely making files available on the Internet is in and of itself a copyright infringement. Beckerman calls the complaint a shocking argument because if it were accepted, it would probably shut down the entire Internet. One of the UK's biggest technology news websites, The Inquirer, also today highlights the frightening development in an article entitled, RIAA Wants the Internet Shut Down. The U.S. government has also filed legal briefs supporting the RIAA's argument. And there's more to that story and lots of links on mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Moving on, Democrats reject key 9/11 panel suggestion. This is coming from the Washington Post. It was a solemn pledge repeated by Democratic leaders and candidates over and over. If elected to the majority in Congress, Democrats would implement all of the recommendations of the bipartisan commission that examined the attacks of September 11th. But with control of Congress now secured, Democratic leaders have decided for now against implementing the one measure that would affect them most directly, a wholesale reorganization of Congress to improve oversight and funding of the nation's intelligence agencies. Instead, Democratic leaders may create a panel to look at the issue and produce recommendations, according to congressional aides and lawmakers. Because plans for implementing the commission's recommendations are still fluid, Democratic officials would not speak for the record. But aides on the House and Senate Appropriations, Armed Services, and Intelligence Committees confirmed this week that a reorganization of Congress would not be a part of the package of Homeland Security changes up for passage in the first 100 hours of the Democratic Congress. I don't think that suggestion is going anywhere, said Representative C.W. Bill Young, Republican from Florida, the chairman of the Appropriations Defense Subcommittee and a close ally of the incoming subcommittee chairman, Representative John P. Murtha. That is not going to be their party position. Moving on to another super scary story. This one's coming from KurtNemo.com. Neocon Gingrich calls for trashing First Amendment. It is really quite amazing. Newt Gingrich slanders the Constitution, arrogantly suggests the First Amendment be sent to the deep freeze, and few complain, few even comment, except bloggers at Huffington Post, a bastion of so-called liberalism. Speaking in Manchester, Gingrich said the country may need a different set of rules to reduce terrorists' ability to use the Internet and free speech to recruit and get out their message, the Boston Globe reported. If we didn't live in Bush-Zorro times, the response would be immediate and scorching, and Gingrich would be pilloried as the fascist he is. But we live in Bush-Zorro times, so little was said except at the aforementioned Huffington Post and a handful of other sites. Our rights are not Gingrich's to eliminate. We are endowed with them by our Creator, as some dude named Jefferson wrote in 1776. notes a post on the Northwest Progressive blog. This man intends to be the Republican president of 2008. Perhaps we should change the title of the office to Unser geliebter Führer with a snappy long-arm salute of respect should he win, another post declares on the Technocrat site. In keeping with the Republicans' continuing power grab, trampling all over the U.S. Constitution, Newt says free speech laws need to be changed before we lose a city, which he said could happen in the next decade, writes Short News, a German news site. And you can go to theunionleader.com for the whole story on that. It's basically Gingrich was at an event honoring the First Amendment, and he gets up on stage and says we need to curtail the First Amendment. UK police adorn Nazi chic uniforms begin to befit fascist policies abolishing freedom of speech. This is coming from Propaganda Matrix, and you got to see the picture, so you got to go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. British police have been photographed wearing bizarre Nazi-like insignia on their uniforms as the attire of Tony Blair's enforcers begins to complement the totalitarian society the Prime Minister is creating by openly abolishing freedom of speech and freedom of assembly under draconian crime and terror laws. This image was sent to us by a protester who joined around 200 others to march against the presence of the British National Party in Blackpool, England, last Saturday. Many consider the BNP to be a neo-Nazi front organization, but some demonstrators probably left the event more worried about the similar direction in which UK police are heading, as exemplified by their changing uniforms. The police officer photographed is wearing black attire that clearly bears the logo of a yellow lightning strike on a red background. It looks somewhat similar, like a single S as opposed to the double SS worn by Hitler's feared Schutzstaffel, otherwise known as the Waffen-SS, the Führer's bodyguards who later grew to become the elite corps of the Third Reich's army. The Sieg Heil hand salute is purely coincidental, but it marries the context. So again, you got to see the photos. Next story, dollar plunges to 15-year low. This is coming from The Telegraph UK. The dollar tumbled to a near 15-year low against sterling yesterday on fresh signs of economic trouble in the United States. An 8.3% crash in U.S. industrial orders and an admission by the Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke that Washington does not know how bad housing really is set off another day of wild gyrations on the currency markets. The truckers index of tonnage shipped by U.S. haulage companies was down 1.8% in October, a leading indicator of contraction. Merrill Lynch called the fall borderline recessionary. WorldNet Daily reports, and others as well, Jimmy Carter blames Israel for Mideast conflict. In some of the harshest and one-sided language he has used to date, former Democratic President Jimmy Carter called Israeli domination over Palestinians atrocious in an interview on ABC's Good Morning America. Carter said there was no doubt that a minority of Israelis are perpetuating apartheid on the people in Palestine, the Palestinian people. Carter called Israel's occupation the prime cause of continuing violence in the Middle East. And contrary to the United Nations resolutions, contrary to the official policy of the United States government, contrary to the Quartet's so-called roadmap, all of those things, and contrary to the majority of Israeli people's opinion, this occupation and confiscation and colonization of land in the West Bank is the prime cause of a continuation of violence in the Middle East, he said. And what is being done to the Palestinians under Israeli domination is really atrocious. It's a terrible affliction on these people. Our next story I don't think I'm actually going to get to because it's accompanied by a longer clip, but it's also coming from KurtNemo.com, Information Clearinghouse, and the entire video is posted on Media Monarchy. It's called John Stockwell and America's Third World War. John Stockwell, a former CIA station chief in Angola in 1976, working for then-director of the CIA, George Bush. He spent 13 years in the agency. Here he gives a short history of CIA covert options. He's a very compelling speaker and the highest-level CIA officer to testify to Congress about his actions. He estimates that over 6 million people have died in CIA covert actions, and this was in the late 80s. Other stories, Phil Donahue has an anti-war documentary coming out called Body of War. The Times Online is reporting that the U.S. actually carried out the madrasa bombing last month in Pakistan, in which 82 students were killed. The madrasa in the tribal agency of Bajur was bombed during a visit to Pakistan by the Prince of Wales amid allegations that it was being used to train suicide bombers. We thought it would be less damaging if we said we did it rather than the U.S., said a key aide to President Pervez Musharraf. But there was a lot of collateral damage, and we've requested the Americans not to do it again. There's a story that actually came from the Willamette Week about how COIN and KPTV here in Portland are using what's called VNRs, video news releases. These are basically phony news pieces put together by private companies and passed off as news. There's a documentary coming out from Sacred Cow Productions about the drug war. There's all kinds of other stuff I'm not going to be able to get to today, but you can always go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all this news. I thank you for listening. I'll be back next week, Friday at 10 a.m. Like I said earlier, and what is posted on the page, good news is that there are now podcasts available on radioforall.net. That may be a temporary home. I'm not really sure. I'm just glad to get them up and out there and posted. If you like the show, tell somebody about it. Pass the link along, bookmark it, add a link to your blog, and I appreciate you for listening. We're going to go out the way we came in by listening to the one and only John Lennon. He said before, apathy isn't it, and I'll tell you to get active or get radioactive. So my name's James. You've been listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. I know time flies so quickly. But when I see you, darling, it's like we both are falling in love again. It'll be just like stars. Starting over.
whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.